Welcome to today's episode 2 of the Epicenter Kaveri Physician Education Initiative. Today we are going to talk about diagnosis and diagnostic tools for us to be able to know whether a person has got epilepsy and what type of epilepsy they have. Armamentarium of the tests that we need to do in order to diagnose epilepsy starts with the history, because 3/4 of the diagnosis is evident in proper history taking. Then there is a little bit of contribution from the physical examination. One of the most important tests we do in the diagnosis of epilepsy is the electroencephalogram or the EEG. Next comes neuroimaging, in which we have the CT, MRI, more sophisticated tests like the SPECT and the PET and FDG PET, etc. So let us look at each of these in greater detail. Now, what are the factors that are important, or what are the axes that we have to follow in order to come up with a diagnosis for epilepsy? First and foremost, we have to identify whether this episode or spell or seizure that the patient is having is epilepsy, because there are so many things that can confuse and look like epilepsy. So axis one is to identify, is it an epileptic seizure? Axis two is to identify the type of seizure, because as I said in episode 1, the classification of epilepsy depends on the type of seizure, or what we call as the seizure semiology. Now, when we know the type of seizure, treatments are different, classification of the seizure is possible, prognostication is possible, and for this we follow the international classification of epileptic seizures. Then we do investigations which will confirm our impression that it is an epileptic seizure. And this is where the EEG and the neuroimaging come into place. Beyond that, there are certain epileptic syndromes. So we look for combination of other manifestations in the person to see maybe it could be an epileptic syndrome. And if it is an epileptic syndrome, we have to go further and investigate with genetic tests, etc. Together with EEG and MRI, we very often also do a whole set of blood tests. Normally nothing very specific or very complicated to epilepsy, but more like a master health checkup kind of thing, where we make sure that the other systems and other comorbidities which may complicate epilepsy are there or not, and if so, what is the status of those things. I emphasize a lot on a proper history taking. So we need to ask a lot of questions of the patient. When did the first seizure happen? Many patients will come to us and say, I'm having epilepsy for the past 20 years, and they'll start talking to you about the last few seizures that they had. But ask them, delve into it, dig deep, and ask them about the first seizure that they had, because that gives us a far more information than some of the recent seizures, which would have been modified both by time and by treatment and the natural history of epilepsy. So did you experience any aura? Was there any warning? Was there a prodrome? What actually happens during the seizure? Many people now have a home video of the seizure. So ask them and see that. What happens after the seizure is over? Is it more in the mornings? Is it more in the evenings? Or are they nocturnal seizures? What are the triggering factors? Have you noticed that something particular triggers it? How many seizures in a month or in a week or in a year do you get? All of this, what has been the maximum period in these 20 years or 10 years or 5 years where you have not had any seizures at all? And during that period, were you on medication or not? And do you get a mixture of types of seizures, or you get only one kind of seizure? All of this gives us a lot of localization information. Now, how often have you been taken to the ER? I had a patient who, as a child, was taken every month at least once with the status epilepticus to the ER. That poor child's brain is permanently damaged. And though we have stopped the seizures and everything now, the recurrent attacks of status epilepticus have completely messed up his brain. So you need to also ask if they have had any injuries related to the seizure. Now, shoulder dislocation happens very commonly in many types of generalized tonic-clonic seizures. So they might have had recurrent shoulder dislocation, and sometimes they learn to put it back themselves. And for such patients, it may be necessary for us to stabilize that shoulder in the light of recurrent dislocation after future seizures. So all of this in addition to the medication history. So what are all the medicines you took? What are the doses you took? What worked for you? What did not work for you? What is the name of the medicine? Did you try alternative methods of medicine? All of these questions are something that I always ask in every patient with epilepsy. When it comes to febrile seizures, which we see in children, you need to get some extra history to know whether it is a simple febrile seizure or a complex febrile seizure. A simple febrile seizure is usually just one seizure in 24 hours associated with high fever. It's usually generalized, it lasts less than 15 minutes, and the child quickly returns to normal after the seizure. Whereas in complex febrile seizures, the chances of getting multiple seizures in 24 hours is there. It can be a focal seizure, it can be generalized, it can be very prolonged sometimes. And the child doesn't fully get back to normal after the seizure because the intensity of the seizure is much greater. Also, sometimes after a complex febrile seizure, you might find a Todd's paralysis or a temporary paralysis of a limb. Next, we move on to the physical examination. In epilepsy, the physical examination is less important, less critical than it is for many other neurological illnesses. But we do a full general examination of the patient to check for comorbidities. We check the patient if they've got any injuries consequent to a seizure. How is their cardiac? Their cardiac status is very important because you can get seizures and seizure-like episodes when after cardiac arrhythmias, various heart rhythm disturbances can create seizure-like, they can cause syncope. Also, check whether there are any carotid murmurs, heart murmurs, etc. And in pseudo-seizures or psychogenic seizures, sometimes they will be in a high adrenergic state. So you'll find that the pulse is very fast, they're sweating, they're agitated, that kind of thing. Then see if there is any limb asymmetry, because very often a childhood or a birth history, a birth injury, leaving behind a residual hemiparesis can be associated with long-term epilepsy. See if there are any ulcerations of the mouth or tongue bites. See if there is any gingival hyperplasia, if they have been on phenytoin. Unfortunately, there's a misunderstanding that gingival hyperplasia occurs with any anti-epileptic drug, which is a wrong belief. It only occurs as a complication to long-term phenytoin usage. Long-term barbiturate usage can cause Dupuytren's contractures. You might find certain nystagmus, you may find ataxia, which can be both a complication of the drug that they are taking, especially phenytoin, or even carbamazepine can cause gait ataxia. Next, we move on to the EEG or the electroencephalogram. What are the indications for doing the EEG? It is mainly for the diagnosis of epilepsy. But unlike the ECG, which is so terrific and at localizing certain things, the EEG is a little bit more broad in its utility. So if you find an abnormal EEG, it is useful to diagnose epilepsy. But finding a normal EEG does not exclude epilepsy. We use the EEG also for what is called as electroclinical classification of the seizure. we may need it to reconsider a diagnosis of epilepsy in a patient who was declared non-epileptic. We may use it for when we are planning to stop the anti-epileptic, because if external seizures are not there, we want electrical seizures also to stop. It's very useful to diagnose a condition called non-convulsive status epilepticus, where the brain will be continuously seizing but the patient will just be drowsy or unconscious and have no external seizures. Any patient with a fluctuating mental status or a sensorium, the EEG may be useful in identifying the cause. In syncope, we may get a normal EEG, but we usually do it to check. And very sometimes after brain injuries, brain head trauma itself, we may do an EEG. Understand that the EEG has to be done properly. There is a process. The electrodes have to be placed correctly. Now, every diagnostic center is running an EEG, but all EEGs are not equal. So you have to make sure that it is done by a trained technician who places the electrodes in the correct location, because it is reflecting what is happening in the brain below. And many labs are also doing 10-minute EEGs, which is absolutely not correct. We have to do a recording for a minimum of 30 minutes. And usually most abnormalities are picked up in the first 20 minutes of recording. Also, in the outside diagnostic centers, they don't do the adequate, correct provocative measures which are necessary. Now, these provocative measures help us to get more information out of the EEG. So we do sleep and awake studies. We do EEGs after sleep deprivation, where we make the patient have only 4 hours of sleep, where they go to bed at 12, wake up at 4, get their EEG around 9:30, 10 in the morning. Then there is a process called photic stimulation for us to identify certain occipital epilepsies. Now, this photic stimulation, we give intermittent photic. There is a light which is flashed in the eye of the patient. And this picks up what is known as photosensitive discharges. And such patients can provoke a seizure when sunlight is streaming through shaking leaves, when the striped curtains are flying in the air, etc., when they look down an escalator. So when they see all these lines moving, it can provoke a seizure in such patients. The other provocation that we use is hyperventilation. Sometimes the patient will tell us that these triggers always bring on a seizure. So in the lab, we recreate that situation. So in intermittent photic stimulation, we give strobe light flashes of 1 to 30 Hz and we pick up the various responses. Also, in hyperventilation, we ask them to take deep regular respirations at 20 per minute for 2 to 4 minutes. This will drop the plasma carbon dioxide and then it creates certain changes in the. This is very, very useful and classical to bring out discharges in absence epilepsy or petit mal. Now, the EEG has also undergone a lot of advances, and now we have prolonged EEG, ambulatory EEG, etc. In ambulatory EEG, like a Holter, we fix a EEG unit to the patient. They go about their day and then we see if they are getting any subtle seizures they are not aware of. The prolonged EEG is very useful, especially for pre-surgical evaluation, to identify whether the seizure is a real seizure or not, because it is a time-locked EEG system between the video and the EEG. So when that video shows us an event, we will see simultaneously what is happening in the brain in the EEG. And this is used for recurrent epileptic episodes, to identify non-epileptic events, to identify the seizure and improve our classification of the seizure, and to determine whether this patient will be suitable for which kind of treatment, whether medicine or medical or surgical or both. Next, we move on to neuroimaging. Now, when it comes to neuroimaging, what is most valuable is, very often people want to a cheaper test. They say we would like to have a CT scan. Now, the CT scan in epilepsy gives us much less information than an MRI does. If you have to choose one test, it is desirable for you to choose the MRI as the primary neuroimaging modality. And even the MRI is not done as a routine MRI. It is done as what is called as the epilepsy protocol. Now, in the epilepsy protocol, the tilt, gradient tilt of the MRI is different. It takes thinner slices of the temporal lobe and the tilt is different. So the information you get is different. So neuroimaging of choice as a first step in epilepsy diagnosis is the MRI and not the CT. Having said that, the CT can, however, pick up any calcific lesions like we would see in neurocystic sarcosis or in tuberculosis or in any other calcific meningiomas, etc. In the MRI, we look for various things. We look for congenital faulty development of the brain, like polymicrogyria, focal cortical dysplasia. We also look for neurocutaneous syndromes like Sturge-Weber syndrome, tuberous sclerosis, where we'll find nodules in tuberous sclerosis, which are called tubers, and we'll find vascular patches in Sturge-Weber. It will help us to identify a cavernous hemangioma, which is very frequent in drug-resistant epilepsy. It will help us to identify any abnormal gray matter. And it will help us to pick up tubers and also to identify atrophy of the hippocampus and the mesial temporal sclerosis. Further advances are possible for functional neuroimaging using SPECT, PET-CT and FDG-PET. The routine blood tests, I've already said, will be mostly like a master health checkup and genetic tests in epilepsy syndromes. Now, this is the whole range of investigation that a patient with epilepsy requires in order to be clearly diagnosed as whether having epilepsy or not, the differential diagnosis of it, the etiology, the right classification of the seizure, the choice of the right medication, and the choice of the right type of treatment. So I hope you found this episode useful, and please understand that understanding that what these tests are, you as a physician will actually help us as neurologists, because sometimes patients misunderstand that we as specialists over investigate them. Now these are absolutely mandatory for us to come to a clear and accurate diagnosis. Thank you.